I really wanted to try to find the purity of the art of selling. And for me, well, I was able to do that really in my Perfecto journey. Keith Butler and Rob Watson kind of gave me my first language around intent. Like, your intent is to make customers successful. And that really changed a lot for me, because it kind of oriented me internally, like, the North Star is the customer. If you make them successful, then you get the right to ask for value in exchange. And that brought a real purity to the art for me. Like, hey, focus on the customer, be wildly fanatical about their success and their adoption of whatever technology you're selling and the problem that you're solving. And if you do that really well, then you can have great outcomes. And I think that's probably a bit of a lost art in sales that I think that I push really hard with my teams to spend their time and energy on focusing on the customer, making sure that they get the outcomes that they're signing up for. If they do that, then we'll get value in exchange and it'll be a win for everybody.
Welcome to Hunters and Unicorns. Today we are joined by Sam Costello, the SVP of Harness. From banking to selling groundbreaking software solutions and embracing the medic sales methodology, Sam's story is one of transformation, resilience, and success. In this episode, we explore the genuine passion for solving customer problems, the importance of a purpose-driven career, and the impact of mentorship. This is his playbook.
Welcome to Hunters and Unicorns. I'm Simon Coutis and I'm joined by my co-host, Ollie Cooney.
Welcome back to the show, everyone.
And it's an absolute privilege to be joined by Sam Costello. Sam, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here in beautiful London. I'm excited.
Welcome to the show, Sam. Great to have you in the UK, mate.
Thank you.
Sam, it's an amazing career that you've obviously developed for yourself, and we're really excited to get into it. But actually, we want to start by understanding where it all began. So just take us right to the beginning, because it's such an interesting journey and an interesting transition. Just take us right to the beginning.
Yeah, thanks. It's funny, you know, I interview a lot of people and they'll usually tell you some interesting story about how they kind of fell into sales. That's not really my story. Like, I wanted to be in sales really from the time I can remember wanting a career. My dad was in sales, his dad was in sales, and I thought that was like the most noble profession you could have, be a salesman. And my dad was like, hey, do something where you can be on commission and control your own income. And my mom is like a fierce competitor. So she's probably, it's March, she's in Florida somewhere right now, probably trying to make a putt to beat somebody in a golf tournament. And so I wanted to be in sales and I thought that was great. And I did what a lot of people do. You know, you start like cutting grass and cleaning up lawns and things like that to make money. And then I found my way into college. I got a finance degree and I found my way into banking, but in the selling capacity. Worked for this regional bank in New York called M&T Bank, but they had an office in Ohio. And did that for almost 8 years in a selling capacity and learned a lot in that journey, actually, that really helped me in my sales career. And during the kind of the end of that, about 6 years into that tenure, I was at a barbecue in the neighborhood, met this guy named Jason Eubanks. And he told me all about like how you got to get out of banking and get into technology, and technology is the future, and that's where the wealth creation is going to come, and technology is going to change the world, and you're in the wrong vertical, basically, and you need to apply your sales skills to something else. And that set me off on a journey of like even trying to understand what he was really talking about. And about 2 years later, I ended up moving over to CA. He hired me as one of his sales reps there. And that started me off on a journey to like even figure out how to sell technology. I didn't know what a mainframe was. I like account manager with 143 SKUs in my bag, but I've never sold tech before. But that kind of set me off on my journey to where I'm at today.
Go on.
How did your background in finance, even if it wasn't a selling capacity, how do you think that's really helped you in your sales career?
Yeah, well, it was interesting. I had this amazing boss that hired me, and they put me on an all commission plan when I came out of college. So like I had a salary of like $1,400 for 3 months, and then it was all commission from there. And he taught me a couple things. One is like we had a differentiated product. Now I have words for that, but then I didn't. But it was like we did this thing that no one else did, and I went and took it into the market. And then secondly, taught me how to prospect, because we were a bank, but we had no branches in the Ohio area. So we had to go prospect all of our own leads by talking to builders and realtors and things like that. And I can remember him one day, he's like, hey, get in the car, we're going to go prospecting. And this was like foreign concept to me. And he puts me in the car, we drive like an hour and 15 minutes out, to talk to this builder. And this guy builds like 4 houses a year, like not very much volume. Even if he gave you all of his business, it wasn't going to be a lot, right? The point was you got to put the work in. So we go out there and meet this guy. And he's like, yeah, hey, listen, the product sounds interesting. I'm happy to refer my people to you. And then my boss taught me an important lesson that day. He asked at the very end, hey, do you know anybody else that we should be talking to that we can go spend time with? And he's like, well, I heard there's this new builder coming into town and they're just setting up their office on this highway outside of Columbus. And so I thought, okay, I don't know what this means, but great. And my boss like, all right, we're going there. I'm like, right now? He's like, yeah, we're going there right now. It's like an hour and a half away. We get in the car, go over there, and they're just setting up their first office. And that became my largest customer. And over the next 4 years, like we did so much volume with that particular account that it really changed my life and catapulted me to the top of the sales rankings at that bank. But just taught me the importance of like prospecting, getting out there, doing the hard work, and finding the next great lead that could change your life.
Yeah. You mentioned at the beginning of the statement or the beginning of the conversation, you know, getting into sales was a noble career, which, you know, there's a lot of stigma attached to sales. Why was it, and where did that inspiration of it being a noble career come from for you?
Yeah, I think I probably thought of my dad as a very noble guy. Okay. And so for me, selling was a noble endeavor to go after. But I think today, if you go out and ask people what do they think when they think of sales, it's probably not very flattering. Yeah. You know, I know in America, if I ask, hey, what do you think a salesman? The first image you'll usually get is some used car sales guy that's ready to come out of that glass door at the dealership, pounce on you, give you some car that's not great at a high price with a bad loan around it. And so I really wanted to try to find the purity of the art of selling. And for me, well, I was able to do that really in my Perfecto journey. Keith Butler and Rob Watson kind of gave me my first language around intent. Like your intent is to make customers successful. And that really changed a lot for me because it kind of oriented me internally, like the North Star is the customer. If you make them successful, then you get the right to ask for value in exchange. And that brought a real purity to the art for me. Like, hey, focus on the customer, be wildly fanatical about their success and their adoption of whatever technology you're selling and the problem that you're solving. And if you do that really well, then you can have great outcomes. And I think that's probably a bit of a lost art in sales that I think that I push really hard with my teams to spend their time and energy on focusing on the customer, making sure that they get the outcomes that they're signing up for. If they do that, then we'll get value in exchange and it'll be a win for everybody.
Well, we spoke about this with Rick Kicker, didn't we? You know, and we were talking about it being wizardry, you know, and the art of selling, but it's not. It's the, how do we take a customer for a journey and make their life easier by giving them an understanding of some of the problems and the hypothesis of problems that you see, and the variety of different technologies that could potentially solve that problem, but how potentially your technology solves that problem better, right?
That's it.
And I think that's a really interesting concept, rather than it just being, you know, we're here to try and pull the wool over somebody's eyes or try and, you know, as we said, wizardry. It is part of that, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it all starts with the problem you're solving. Like if you do great discovery and you understand the pain that the customer's feeling or the gain, some business outcome they're trying to accomplish, and you orient around that, and then you put your time and energy in like, can I solve that problem? Can I solve it in a unique way that nobody else in the market does? And if I can, then I'm like maniacal about it. Like I'm a dog on a bone. Like we are here to solve this problem. We're the best in the world at doing it. We're not going to relent until we do type of approach. And I think that actually gives you a lot of leeway during the sales cycle if your intent is pure. Right, that's actually the key about the whole thing. It's like it's got to come from a pure place. You have to really genuinely care about the customer. You can't just say it. If you just say it, it's hollow words. But if you really feel it and you mean it, then it actually gives you a bunch of leeway during the cycle. And what I mean by that is we used to talk about falling on your intent. You know, there's this famous saying, the customer is always right. I actually disagree with that. I don't think that's valid. You know, customers, like I'm taking customers on a transformation to change the business process of software delivery in their shop. I've done it with 600 customers around the world. Like I actually know quite a bit about this space and I have an incredible team that is really, really in the details of these journeys. And these customers are doing it for the first or second time in their shop. So actually we have a really great opinion on how we can be successful. What have other customers failed on that we want to help you avoid? And so the customer's not always right in these journeys. And your job as a seller is to be the Sherpa, like guide them to the outcome they're trying to go for using your expertise and experience. And so we teach falling on your intent, you know, and that might mean, hey, I'm here to make you successful. And I know that you want to do a proof of concept and prove out the technology and just show everybody in the organization what's possible. My experience says if we don't talk to the executive that has to say yes to that project before we go do a proof of value, our chances of success are cut in half. Because executives have to carry the water here with us to make sure that it gets funding, that it is successful once it's brought into the house. And so we have to go get with that person before we do a POV. Now, that's hard. Some people, it makes them uncomfortable. And sometimes a buyer doesn't want to do that. Like, oh, I don't want to expose this to my boss yet. And I'm not sure about that. And that's when I fall back on my tent. Hey, I'm here to make you successful. I want you to win.
Yep.
And winning means we need to talk to the people that have to say yes to make sure we're successful in the project. Yeah.
And this goes right back to the very beginning. And I don't want to skip a few steps because I definitely want to start, exploring the Perfecto days. But one of the reasons that we spoke about that you joined Harness and that you chose Harness as an organization was because of a conversation that you had with Jyoti, right? Yeah. Which really helped you believe in the journey and the problem that Harness is solving, so that when you go into those types of conversations, you are going in there with intent.
Absolutely.
Can you just give us a bit more of a...
For sure. I think, the easiest way to have pure intent is to really love the problem that you're solving. Really have a passion for solving that for the customer. And so, we had a great run at Perfecto. I'm happy to unpack that. But when it was time to do the next thing, there was some really great opportunities available to me in the market, which was fun to explore. And I did. I met with Jyoti, flew to California, sat in his office, and he blew me away with his vision of how he was going to transform the way that enterprises delivered software. That he was going to help every company in the world deliver software like they were Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Google, even if they were an insurance company or a bank or an automotive manufacturer or a retailer. And to me, I lived in Ohio at the time, and I was selling to these companies that were being disrupted by the digital transformation. They were fighting off competitors from Silicon Valley. And I thought, man, what a great endeavor. We could help these companies be amazing at this business process of software delivery, and we could help them be viable for the next few decades so that my neighbors and friends could be employed by these great companies versus being disrupted and put out of business by Silicon Valley. And so I thought the mission was great. And I'm like, yeah, I could sign up and get excited about that. To me, it was more exciting than a lot of the point tools in the market. It was like, solve this point problem for A, B, or C company. I wanted to go for a platform play. I wanted to change something that I thought could have huge business outcomes for companies that I could get excited about. And actually, that's one of the reasons, even 5 years into this journey, I still remain really excited about the opportunities, because I'm seeing it play out in the market. I'm seeing us take market share, make customers wildly successful, and the problem is still very real in the market, and it still excites me every day. So it's easy to see like how I could put another 5 years in and really, really change this space and help these companies. And that allows me to come to work every day with the energy and excitement to say, like, We are changing the way these companies are doing this. We can make them successful. We're uniquely positioned to do it. And so carry that enthusiasm. And I think it's really kind of infectious across the team at Harness.
Where did that focus come from in terms of that kind of mindset being very, very customer focused? Where did that begin for you?
Funny, when I was a teenager. I mean, my brother owned a landscaping company. He's an entrepreneur. I come from one of six kids, so I'm in the middle, so I need attention, and I was always fighting for my spot in the family. But come from an amazing group of siblings. But my older brother had started his own business at the age of 16. He bought a truck and a trailer, and he was out there winning accounts. And I started working for him, and his differentiation, we were cutting grass, really, was like the attention to detail. Like, we were so passionate about, I know this sounds silly, but we would, like, you might call it edging. We would weedy like the curbs every week. They looked pristine. And when you wanted to like take the mower and turn it, like a commercial mower, like that spins and usually takes out a chunk of grass, he would never let you do that. You had to turn it by hand. And like, just the little details that were like, we're going to make these lawns look so good. These customers are going to be so happy, and we'll charge a little bit more than everybody else in the market. A couple more bucks per lawn per week. But it was a great revenue generator for us. And that was really the first time I really got into the art of like paying attention to the deals, really focusing on the customer, making them successful. And if you did that, you could get a premium in the market.
I mean, it's so interesting that something so early in your life can really have such a profound impact to kind of shape your whole mindset and focus, and how well that's obviously served you well. And you've had some amazing wins, right? You've closed some huge deals. What can you tell us about some of those deals and talk to us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's funny you say that, like, I can go back across my career and pick moments in time that changed the trajectory of my career. And someone, maybe a mentor that just invested a little bit extra. And I'll tell you a story. I was, went to CA, did that for almost 4 years. Then I went to Oracle. In my mind, Oracle is like the Shark Tank, like the best, most elite sellers. If you could make it there, you could make it anywhere. And I was like, I wanted to find out if I was any good at this thing. Like, can I really be great at selling? So I went to Oracle. They handed me an account list, had six names on it. And one of those names was Greenfield, which, if you can believe that for Oracle, the company had actually no business with them. And I remember people were like, yeah, don't spend time with that account because they don't buy anything. Which was an invitation for me. I was like, I think I'll rip that apart and find out what's going on there. And I did. And I ended up, fast forward the clock about 18 months. I did a set of transactions totaling about $30 million in a fairly short period of time. And which was a huge win, not only for Oracle because it was Greenfield, but for me personally. And I didn't have the language then, but what I know now is I had built this world-class champion, this person that really wanted to drive change, and they were so locked into the problem the company was feeling, and we were able to differentiate our technology and show how we solved it uniquely in the space. But I met the CIO of that organization as part of the transaction, and we ended up becoming friends because signing the contract is the start of making them successful, right? Then you got to actually go do the work. And I stayed close to the project, was really focused on their onboarding adoption. And we would meet quarterly. We'd have dinner, and he was a foodie wine guy like me. So we had a lot in common. And I remember towards the end of my Oracle journey, I'd gone into leadership, and we were out at dinner one night, and he's like, well, what's next for you? Which I thought was actually a very nice question from a CIO, because normally it's like, what are you going to do for me? Like, we're still making the adoption process was ongoing, we're making them successful. And I'm like, I don't know. He's like, I've noticed that you really care about your customers. I can tell that you spend a lot of time making us successful. And, my career has taught me that the big companies are very hard to change. They're kind of like cruise ships. You're not going to change the direction of a company like that. Have you ever considered startups? And I'm like, what's a startup? What are you talking about? And he told me about how he had helped grow a startup early on in his career on the West Coast. It was like some of the most fulfilling, life-changing work he'd ever done. And I thought, well, I gotta figure out what you're even talking about. That was news to me that there was a such thing as pre-IPO high growth tech startups. Mm-hmm. I had not really heard about this. And so it set me off on a journey of discovery, finding out what are these companies and how do you get into them? And I learned about the venture capitalists, and they wanted this thing called Medic, and there was companies in the market hiring like Medallia and others. And I started to study the space, did some interviewing, and I was leading at Oracle, and that was my passion. I was like, I want to lead people. I'm going to help them be successful. I want to help them unlock their personal and professional goals. But I've done this even today, a lot of times they'll look at somebody coming to the organization and say, hey, why don't you take a step down here, show us you can be successful, and then we'll move you up. And many times that's the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. That actually was my journey at Harness, taking a step back to take a role there. But in this case, I was like, I can't be an individual contributor again. I really want to lead. This is my calling in life. And I found these guys at Perfecto, or they found me, or a recruiter actually connected us. And I remember meeting with Rob Watson a couple of times, and I'm assuming now that I look back, maybe my intangibles kind of jumped off the page for him, because I don't know that I had all the requisite skills for what they were looking for at the time. But Rob and I really hit it off over a few conversations, and he flew me to Boston to interview with Keith. But before I could go into the interview, he takes me into this room, and big whiteboard on there. And if you know Rob,
he loves a whiteboard.
Yeah. It's like Russell Crowe in A Beautiful Mind. He's plotting this whole thing out. Yeah. And he's basically teaching me Medic in a sales process.
Yeah.
And I'm a reasonably quick learner. And I'm like, okay, I got some of this. And he goes, all right, now go down to Keith's office. And Keith starts grilling me on what Rob had just taught me. And I was able, obviously, to uptake enough of it and show Keith that I could learn quickly to what they wanted to teach me, that they gave me the opportunity to lead in a playbook company. And that really changed my career. I mean, the learning from those guys and learning how to operate and how to recruit and develop people and all that was certainly life-changing and amazing 3.5-year run, and we sold that to private equity and set me off on my next journey.
It's an incredible, as I said, you know, we know lots of different alumni, and the Perfecto alumni is one which I think is, you know, setting the history, right? We do a lot of work with Keith Butler and Robertson, so we understand that group. But I'd be interested that when you're sitting in that room with Rob, and he's obviously going through Medic, what's going through your mind at that time? Is it, you know, we speak about Medic a lot in this show, but at the same time, be interested to get your first take on it. Was it, oh, okay, well, that makes sense, but, you know, I see it as this, or, you know, help us understand.
I was a sponge. I was like, I wasn't going to challenge anybody. I was like trying to learn. And, but what it really, for me, it was like, you know, when you crack a safe and the tumblers align, that's what it was for me. I was like, oh my, I can see how, like on the deal I just told you about previously, how I had done a lot of those things, but didn't know what to call it.
Yeah.
Didn't know like an economic buyer or champion, these concepts. And then it made logical sense to me. I was like, this is great. What a beautiful framework that you can use now to take deals, overlay them against the framework, understand where the gaps are at, and then use it to go close them. Like, what a great tool for a seller to be able to use to be more consistent in how they go to market and how they win. And so I got it right away. It made tons of sense to me. Now the application of it, you know, takes time. You know, you got to go into the market and apply it and knock your head around a little bit, but it made sense to me. And I was like, yes, this is beautiful. Like, it's teachable. It's you can prescribe this to sellers, show them how to use it and adopt it, and leaders, and it will change the way they go to market. So I thought it was like, man, thank God somebody figured this out and put it on paper, because it's capturing what I think a lot of great sellers do some of these things naturally. But the beautiful thing about Medic or MedPick is the predictability of it once you understand it, being able to use it every time to increase your win rate.
Yeah. So at that point, you obviously chose to go and work for Perfecto. You speak a lot about mentorship in you know, who and how you operate as a leader today. Do you think that's the first point for you to be inspired by that? Did you choose Perfecto because of the technology, or did you choose Perfecto because of the path it could show you?
I think it was both. Like, I would never try to sell something I didn't believe in.
Right.
Like, we were trying to help people do testing on mobile devices. Mobile was really hot then. You know, a lot of applications were going on to, you know, the App Store had come out, and we were all consuming applications on our phone. And so I knew companies were struggling to test and deliver a great experience with that. So I loved the problem statement, but to be honest, I really wanted to learn. That was my motive there, was like, how do I get around these guys? In my mind, they're like, wow, this is a whole different playbook. Great people. How do I learn and grow and develop myself? And that definitely got mentored quite a bit during that journey. Had some highs, a couple lows. You know, sometimes being developed and taught in these cultures can be a little bit bumpy.
Yeah.
You know, there's some things that can get intense around the learnings, but I loved every minute of it, valued it so much, and, you know, thankful for everybody there that invested in me.
I think that's a really important part, and I don't think it's something we've actually covered on this show, which is, you know, how do you take that critique, and what advice can you give to anybody going through that development stage of their career where they are probably hearing things that they might not want to hear? What sort of kind of feedback or what sort of advice could you give to any rep that may be going through that and maybe seeing it as more scrutiny than development?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things we hire for, I think probably every playbook company would say they hire for, is coachability. Mm. If you get that right and you hire people that are truly coachable, that want to be great, the learnings are a lot easier. And what I mean by that is, like, I'm a personal believer that you should get better every day until you put your bag away. And I don't care if you're Jody or Carlos or a rep. It doesn't matter. Mm. Your pursuit of excellence should happen every day. And in that pursuit of excellence, you have to assume that there's forces outside of yourself that are going to have to teach you and develop you for that to happen. Mm. Maybe you're reading a book, or you have a leadership coach, or you have a boss that cares and they're investing in you. And so that's the way I approach it. And so when I get coached and they have feedback, even if the packaging isn't lovely, I'm here for the learning so I can grow and develop. And I give people a lot of leeway in that. Maybe the stylistically I might do it different than somebody else, but the opportunity to learn and grow is a gift, and we should embrace it that way. If you're rebuffing coaching, it's probably an ego thing.
Yeah.
9 times out of 10, it's usually you've inflated maybe your own personal opinion too high, and so the feedback isn't coming through because you feel like, hey, why do I have to listen to this person, or why am I getting coached by someone I don't respect? And if that's the case, you probably should find a different mentor or leader to guide you.
Mm. It's really interesting. And I think it's really, because again, we've done a lot of work with Keith, And, you know, every leader and every, you know, when we go back to the 33, every single one of them has a different style. But every time, I don't know about you, I sit down and work with one of the, you know, the person, the mentees that have been mentored by one of them, you can always feel a very similar sort of, you know, personality. And that's why you and Keith obviously aligned at that point. But, you know, Keith is a very caring natured person. Mm. And I think that, you know, having spent, you know, a lot of time with you as well, Sam, I think, you know, it's clear that we've been able to identify that. And you're always out for the pursuit of others rather than yourself, which, you know, has probably kept you in the background probably more than in the foreground, like other sales leaders that we've spoken about. And I think it's, you know, but Keith's the same. Keith's that person that very much sits in the background, which in my opinion is the real kind of, you know, the epicenter of a really strong leader. Would you agree, Si?
Absolutely, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, I call it the value exchange. I don't know if there's probably a better language for it, but,
right.
You know, people have asked me, like, how, you know, you've had a lot of success at Harness, and how did that happen? And, you know, there's a couple reasons I would give you, but from the value exchange perspective, you know, I wake up every day and I try to think, how can I make my boss look great today? And how can I make my teams look great today? If I can do those things well, I'll always be fine.
Yeah.
Like, cause you're bringing value to the organization. And like the one thing about capitalism, it's pretty straightforward. You bring outsized amount of value, you get outsized amount of return.
Yeah.
And so I've always believed that, like, if I put others first and I make them really successful, I'll always be in a good place. And maybe that's kept me in the background a little bit, and that's okay. I'm comfortable there. And but hey, I'm on a podcast for the first time, so maybe I'm coming.
Well, that's why we wanted you here, Sam. I think it's about time that you did get in the limelight. But I think it's, you know, it's interesting because again, we go back to some of that original conversation, which is, you know, the stigma attached to typical salespeople, which is that ego, right? And sometimes when you think about, you know, organizations and this playbook community, you know, there's a lot of, you know, stereotypical, you know. Chest pumping, you know, sales leaders, highly ego driven. And, you know, I think you're a perfect example of the complete opposite of that.
I think ego's probably, like, people think it's bad. I don't think it's bad. Yeah. I think it's thing. If you have too much of it and you don't have enough self-awareness, then it gets out of check, right? It's like Carlos calls it the big donut.
Right.
It's like, looks good, but there's a big hole in the middle, right? Like you think more of yourself than you are. And so I think, you know, every seller that's any good has a certain amount of ego and confidence and swagger. A belief that not only can they make their customers successful, but they're better than their competition and they should win. And I love that. Like you need that to be successful. You just got to keep it. You got to manage it. So it's not bigger than the other parts.
So obviously you've built this amazing career. You've gone through all the, you know, you've gone through all these transitions, but at what point did you find purpose? You know, was it, did you have purpose right from the beginning, or talk to us? Because I know purpose is really, really important and having that North Star. So what is your purpose, and at what point in your career did you discover it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there was a discovery moment for me in that. It's like, my purpose has always been to help people and make them successful. And in work, that is, you know, that means leading and trying to be a great leader and bring my best for the team. In my home life, it's being, you know, a great father and a husband. And, you know, my wife and I are super passionate about philanthropy and generosity. And so we invest a lot of the things that we bring home into other people around the world, trying to help do good there. So my purpose has always been to kind of move the needle, be about people, and be the best version of myself for them. It's definitely not perfect. You can ask anyone that's worked with me. There's plenty of flaws there, but working hard to bring good and do the right thing by people.
And how's that shaped you as a leader, do you think?
Yeah, I tell people, like, I'm a competitor. Back to my mom, I got that from her. We're gonna win, but winning at all costs is not my game. So my purpose is, like, how do we win the right way? How do we win by taking care of of our customers? How do we win by being great teammates to each other? And how do we win by solving important problems in the market that change these companies? And so if I can get alignment on those things, then it's easier for me to feel like I have a purpose and that what I'm doing matters. And even if I'm not, overseas feeding babies that need food, my purpose right now is to do this, and I enjoy it and I love it and find the purpose in just helping others and solving important problems.
So Harness is obviously going through an amazing transformation right now. Obviously, you had you work very closely with Jason. So you reunited with Jason. Obviously, you worked with him previously and then again at Harness. And at the moment, you've obviously got Carlos who's come in and kind of shaking the tree. Tell us a little bit about what's happening at Harness right now and what it's like to be working with Carlos as well.
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, so I ran into Jason. Jason brought me to CA. I didn't see Jason for quite a bit after that. He left to go to BMC, and people always say, why didn't you follow him? And I say, I don't remember being invited, you know. But he went to BMC, and then we reunited at the end of my Perfecto journey. We were traveling from Columbus to Boston, me for Perfecto, and he was at a company called Merck Forged, and I saw him, and I hadn't seen him in probably 7 or 8 years, and he told me about this thing called Harness, and he was talking to Jody about transforming the way companies delivered software, and would I take a meeting with Jody? And I thought, of course, like, I'm not an idiot. I'll take a meeting, but not sure I want to keep going down this path, because, you know, one thing we learned at Perfecto is that that problem technically is hard to solve,
yeah.
And wasn't sure that anyone could really crack the code to transforming that, but yeah, I went to meet with Jody. I told you about that. So I joined the first year of selling. They were about $2 million in revenue, and I got the East Coast, which had about probably $500,000 of revenue and two reps in it, and started building. And you know, it was a really fun journey. One of the fastest journeys to 100 million of any company that's ever come out of the Valley, which is pretty great. And then Carlos came in, and I met Carlos, you know, before he joined, and it was like really exciting for me because back to the coachability and the chance to be developed and grow more. I knew Carlos did certain things differently and that it would be an opportunity for me to learn and grow and develop my skills. And, you know, I can tell you that it's been an amazing change for our business in the sense that, you know, we have real alignment on what we're going after. The talent that's coming into the business right now is exceptional. Like some of the most incredible people I've ever had the privilege to work with are coming in and signing up for the mission to drive Harness forward. And we're tackling the space. We think the tech is really uniquely differentiated, that the TAM is huge. I think, you know, obviously I think we have one of the best CEO founders in the Valley and certainly one of the top operating CROs in the world. And so, you know, for me, it's pretty easy to re-up and go, let's go 5 more years and keep building this thing because the ingredients are there for a great run. And, you know, Carlos has been great. You know, he's really mentored me. He's, you know, he calls us co-pilots. Mm-hmm. So I think he's treated me exceptionally well and really leaned on me for my institutional knowledge of Harness and how we got to where we're at and the customers. And then he's obviously bringing his playbook, and I've linked arms with him on that and helping him drive those outcomes. And so we're having a good time together.
Cool.
It's interesting that he refers to as your co-pilot. I think one of the things that you definitely have in Harness is you do have the hearts and minds of the team. I think that there is a lot of, you know, a lot of people that really look to you for that guidance, for that leadership, and that being complemented by someone with Carlos's leadership, it does seem like a really kind of exciting formula, and we can see the impact that's having right now.
Yeah, it's I think if I've done anything well, it's probably that. You know, I've got pretty strong followership across the people I've worked with. You know, I've got people in my business today that we've worked together for 8, 9 years, going back to even the Perfecto days. And so, you know, I always say you can't be a leader if nobody wants to follow you. Now, that doesn't mean that we can't be soft all the time. And just to keep everyone in the boat, we got to go drive the mission and take the ground. But, you know, I do bring an empathetic approach to leadership, sometimes too empathetic. So I'm working on that. But yeah, I think Carlos and I are kind of hand in glove, really, on operating this thing and bringing our each unique strengths to the table to deliver outsized results.
Yeah, I think, you know, Carlos is a really interesting person, right? He's obviously a person of a huge amount of success in his career. Working with him as your new mentor, what are the kind of the top things that he's showing you and enabling you? And there's two questions here, that being one of them. But what were some of your preconceptions about Carlos coming into this?
Well, I think, you know, I knew Carlos's name for sure, and I'd heard some stories. I didn't quite know what to expect, to be honest. What I found is like a man with really great intensity and passion, really cares about people, probably more than people understand. You know, when we talk privately at dinners or whatever, it's always about the people. Right. How can we grow them, develop them? Who's ready to be promoted? Those things are always top of mind for him. And so I think probably people don't understand the depth of his humanity and wanting people to be great and achieve their own outcomes. And, you know, he'll tell you he's 57. In his journey, he's obviously picked up a certain set of EQ skills around his IQ in the playbook. And I think it's proven to be a great operator and leader for us. So excited at that. What was the first part of the question?
What impact has he brought to the organization? Yeah.
And to you as well.
For sure. They kind of go hand in hand. I mean, what Carlos does well is simplify. It brings simplicity to the process in the sense that, you know, I focus a lot of my time right now on recruiting and prospect generation. And, you know, the deals, we know how to execute the deals. We know how to run the playbook, and we know how to win in this market against our competition. What he's brought is a real focus on how do we get the best people in the world to sign up to be on the mission with us, and how do we prospect at the rep level and leader level so much pipeline that we ensure our own outcome. And you know, it's really beautiful when you kind of make it really easy and simplify it. Now there's a lot underneath each of one of those buckets, but that's the thing that he's brought is a real radical focus on those things. And that's helped bring clarity to what we need to go accomplish in the next few quarters and then the next few years.
Yeah. What is the mission ahead for Harness? I think is that the question you're going to ask?
Yeah. Well, listen, we think we can be a $1 billion ARR company in the next 5 years. We'll IPO somewhere on that continuum whenever the market conditions are favorable for us. But between now and then, it's just, you know, do what I talked about earlier. It's go find people that are in pain, solve the problem that they have, earn the right to solve more of it, because we have a very wide platform. So we can go in with one product or 10 products, whatever the customer needs. But that's really the focus right now is, you know, bring the best people in the world into the business, be maniacal about our prospecting and building pipeline, go execute against the pain that we find in the market and solve that problem for them, make sure they're on board and successful, and then continue to grow that footprint. And so that is the journey. And we have revenue goals around it that I just outlined. And, you know, the IPO is something I don't think about every day. I think about how do we make the customer successful and how do we hit the revenue targets. If we do, an outcome or an IPO will just be an inevitable outcome on that timeline.
Harness, at the stage that you are, you're obviously going through a transformation from kind of that startup scale up to really getting ready for that kind of that IPO journey. But there's some that will say the market's saturated or it's a really tough sell. What can you say about that? What do you think about that?
It's funny. It's a great question. So, I mean, the market's huge. I mean, the way we look at the market is there's 30 million developers in the world. If you assume they cost $100,000 each fully burdened, that's $3 trillion a year being spent writing code. You know, most internal surveys that we talk to customers about and our own survey data tells us that a developer spends about 30% of their time writing code today. So think about that $3 trillion investment. Only 30% of that is actually going to code being written. The other 70% of it's bucketed into this thing we call toil. All the work that developers don't like to do but have to do. You know, babysit deployments and wait for builds to complete and look at log files and all this and all these things. And so we're here to automate the worst part of the developer's job, get them out of the business of being in toil and get them into the business of writing more code. And if we can do that, let's say we take a developer and move them from 30% of their time writing code to 50%, well, 20% of $3 trillion is a lot of productivity drop to the bottom line. And so we believe that the market for us is enormous. You know, one of the ways you can create great value in a market is by solving a complex problem. And so, yes, the problem is complex, and it is not the easiest sale in the world. I'm sure there's point tools out there that are easier to go in and close a quick sale. But the opportunity to build a great business exists for us because of the size of the problem and the complexity around it. And so, you know, you got to embrace the challenge of selling into that because the reward for doing it is so outsized.
Is it a business issue or is it a developer issue you're solving? How are you kind of aligning that to kind of the bigger enterprise goals, and or where does it fit in that spectrum?
Yeah, you know, you can't really separate them, to be honest with you. We had the CTO of Wells Fargo with us last week for our kickoff, and he said developer experience is directly tied to customer experience. In the days of today, software is eating the world. Every business has to be great at the business process of software delivery. If they don't, their market share is at risk, their customer satisfaction is at risk. And if they do it great, increased revenue, increased market share, better NPS scores, all these business outcomes. And so they're directly linked. You know, the more productive and happy a developer is, the better the business outcomes. And so, you know, I think of the business process of software delivery as something that's a top three initiative in most companies that we speak to. And we're directly tied to solving that outcome and producing huge business results for them.
Yeah. Because you spoke about, and we haven't you know, touched on him too much, which is obviously Jyoti Bansal, not only just being one of the best, you know, founders in the world, you know, from a tech space, but also one of the best operators, you know, from his experience at AppDynamics, you know, an organization that really set gold standards in software selling. But as an individual, and we talk about this, you know, when we're talking to potential candidates, is, you know, the completeness of the harness portfolio.
Yeah.
It's 13 moving to 15 modules. Jyoti won't let one of those products out if it's not the best in its class, or at least if it's not joint in its class. But but talk to us about the technology and, you know, the completeness of that technology and the level of quality of the technology.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, you probably can't say enough good things about Jyoti. I mean, I've spent 5.5 years with him now building spent a lot of time with him on this problem statement. You know, he's a visionary when it comes to technology. He understands customers' pain so very well, and he is able to deliver technology that solves their problems at a pace we're just not seeing in the market. And so one of the things that customers absolutely love about Harness is our pace of innovation. Mm-hmm. You know, 40% of our employees are engineers. We can deploy to production anytime we feel like it. And we're delivering a new product about every quarter and a half right now into the market. And not, to your point, not average technology, differentiated technology that solves a problem in a way that no one else in the market is solving it. And so we think that our tech is not only highly differentiated, but the completeness at which we're solving the problem in the market sets us apart from the competition. And one thing I'll add is we're doing it all in a modular approach. So although we have a platform, we don't prescribe to a customer, take this whole thing or nothing. Mm. We have them tell us the problem that you're facing today that's most important, urgent, needs solved right now. And if I have a tool that can solve that for you, then I'll map it back for you and let's go start there.
Yeah.
If I make it successful there, I'll earn the right to take more of it over time. And so we have product managers assigned to every one of those capabilities and products. They are judged. They have QBRs like a salesperson. They sit in front of Jyoti and the CFO and the sales leadership and marketing, and they stand up for their product. How's it doing in the market? How many new logos is it acquired? What's the revenue? Is it on target? Is it behind? And that's how Jyoti measures the business. And so there's an intensity internally in a good way around, we have to be great at each product. And we should be able to beat the competition head to head on any of these modules. And then collectively, if you bring them together into a platform, the results inside the companies can be outsized compared to the competition. So I expect a lot of consolidation and DevOps tooling over the next few years. I think if Harness, you know, if we stay humble and we just keep driving our mission forward, there's no reason we should not be the preeminent player in the space. And, you know, my personal goal is, you know, when you say software delivery in 3 years, it should be synonymous with Harness. Like if I say CRM, you say Salesforce.
Mm-hmm.
That's the goal. And if we can do that, then we're going to build a great business.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the testimony is not just through words and, you know, what the customers are saying. We go back, you know, to the talent that you as an organization and you individually are being able to attract, from the likes of Jeff to the likes of Doug May, you know, some phenomenal individuals coming into this organization. Yeah. So it's kind of, you know, we see it as, you know, the AppDynamic, you know, V2 with on steroids, you know? So I think there's, you know, some great and exciting, you know, team being built together and forged together there as well.
No question about it. And to be compared to AppDynamics is a privilege. So tons of respect for the folks that built that organization and had great outcomes there. You're right. We're getting the best people in the world to sign up for the mission. The list is so long. You named a couple people there.
Yeah.
I'd add, you know, Jim Fahey runs our business. Adam Quartermain here in Europe. Colin Doyle running the UK and I business. You mentioned Jeff Lockhausen in the West. I mean, obviously Carlos is here.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really it's a great collective of people to drive the mission. But the thing I love is that we're so like-minded in how we're going to market and how we're going to market and even internally. You know, you're talking about not great operators just, but also high character people that really want to do great things, not just in the business, but also for the people. And so I think we're going to build a great company together, and I'm excited to have more people hooked up to the cart with me, and we're going to pull this thing down the road.
Why should someone join the journey?
Yeah. You know, you
has he not said it all?
No. I was going to say, no, but, you know, if you're going to sign up, what's in it for them?
What's in it for them?
It's all well and good being part of these amazing teams. But what, if I'm going to sign up to this, what am I going to get for being part of this amazing journey?
Mm. Yeah. You know, you probably hear like the three T's, you know, the TAM, the tech, the team.
Yeah.
I think that's what a lot of people would say. That's how they look for their opportunity in the market. I think if you run the harness through those filters, it's hard to find a company with a bigger TAM that's got a better team. We've talked about a lot of those people with more differentiated technology solving an important problem than we have. On top of that, we've got a culture of development and growth. You know, we are going to train up an amazing group of sellers and leaders to take this space. And, you know, my personal goal is that in 4 or 5 years, that the people coming out of Harness will be the next great generation of leaders to run the next great generation of SaaS and tech companies out of the Valley. And I really believe that's possible. And so, you know, I tell people, if you're coachable and you're hungry and you got drive and ambition and you want to do it the right way, come to this company and build a great business and it will change your career. And I really believe that with my whole heart. I think the one piece of advice that I wish I'd learned earlier is the best thing you can do for your career is pick great companies. Mm. Titles are secondary to the company. Mm. If you find a great company, it is an absolute unlocking moment for careers. Mm. And I think people should make their personal wishes subservient to finding great companies, because if you do that, it's a game changer. I mean, you know, you can have a great title and do great work in a company no one's ever heard of, and no one's ever heard of it. You can do maybe a slightly smaller title and do great work at a company people know about, and man, it puts you on the radar, and the opportunities that start to come your way after doing that is life-changing. And so I think that's the one thing I wish I'd learned earlier. I tell everyone now, like, find a great company, go bring outsized value to it, good things will happen for you.
Yeah, which again is true when you look at even, you know, Jeff, a perfect example, you know, and what you said in the role that when you entered into Harness, you took a step back, right? You took a step back in the career-defined job title as such, right? But, you know, I think that again, is a proof to that, isn't it? And it's like, you know, the people believing in the mission, people believing in the goals.
Yeah. I mean, when I exited Perfecto, I was an AVP. I had 2/3 of the U.S. and like about 23 people in my organization. And Jason Eubanks offered me the opportunity of a lifetime RVP title with 2 reps and a few $100,000 of ARR and the chance to go build. But, you know, I was so locked into the mission and so believed that we could build a great company that it didn't really matter to me. And I thought, if I do a great job, like, good things will happen for me, and I'll let that take care of itself. And, you know, pull up LinkedIn and scroll down. It's worked out over 5.5 years.
Absolutely. Yeah. What's your mission? What's the next 10 years? Obviously, heavily focused on Harness at the moment and growing with Harness and believing in the bigger picture for Harness. But where do you see yourself in 10 years? You know, what's your personal goals?
It's a good question. Spent a lot of time talking about my wife with this. She's like, when are you going to be done doing this? It's hard. You know, for me, like, I'm focused so much on Harness right now. I actually don't spend a lot of time thinking about what I'm going to do next. But if I pull back for a second and really look at the aperture, you know, in 10 years, ideally, you know, we'd have a great outcome at Harness. I don't know if I'd be operating something else or what. I know I love to work, so, and I won't stop doing that. You know, I'd like, Jen and I will start a foundation at some point. We plan to do more philanthropic, I think it's actually the right word to say. Philanthropic work. And, you know, I don't know if I'll operate another company, if I'll support another leader and just keep doing that. I'm not sure about that, but I know I love technology. I love these startups. I like the grind of building things. And so wouldn't surprise me if there's another one down the road.
Sure. And so a CRO position and taking the whole revenue, is that something that, you know, is a dream, or again, going back to what you're saying, it's not necessarily a job title, but the responsibility of a CRO?
Yeah, I think focusing on that is a distraction. That's my personal opinion. Like, saying, being prescriptive and saying, like, I need to be a CRO and I need to do that is a distraction for me, in the sense that I'm here to build a great company. Mm-hmm. I want to be part of something great. You know, if in 5 years I could look back and have had a 10-year run at Harness and build a company that I was proud of, that people in our industry respected, and if people thought about us the way I think about the AppDs and Snowflakes and Zscalers and Mongos and Datadogs of the world, if they thought about us like that, that would be the reward for me, that we would have built a great company and operated in a way that people respected our work and the way we accomplished it. And that would mean a lot to me. And so I'm not prescriptive on, I need to be a CRO for some kind of validation. It's more about building something I'm proud of, doing it with people I love to do it with. And I need to feel like my work is making an impact. So if I got my hands in the soil and I'm part of it, that's what matters to me.
Great. I think this is the point where we reflect on what we've spoken about today. It's been a truly inspirational conversation, spending this time with you today, Sam. And just to kind of take some of the key takeaways that, you know, we've taken and heard about today, is what you've just kind of finished on, which is the importance of actually having purpose and being so focused on the impact you can have on others, whether it's your customers, whether it's your teams. And it almost creates a vacuum, an opportunity for you to kind of grow naturally because you're bringing so much value to so many others. But I don't think it's something that's put on. I think it's so ingrained. It goes right back from your days of kind of cutting grass with your, you know, doing the lawns with your brother, and how that's really helped to shape your focus and that curiosity and all of the other things that go into being an effective salesperson. You can see how it all kind of comes together, but it's all about that intent of just helping others. And we've also spoken about the importance of mentors and how, you know, spending time with these great leaders have really kind of shaped you and given you more intentionality, if that's a word, being more intentional with what you're doing and being more aware of what you're doing to become effective. And when you marry those two things together, you can see the amazing career that you've had. So thank you so much for coming and joining us today and spending this time with us. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you in the studio and here in sunny London. And,
I don't know where you got the sun from. It's raining outside.
Well, listen, it's been a pleasure. And let me, on behalf of everyone at home, let me thank you guys for investing in doing this and putting so many amazing people on this podcast. I know I've personally got to grow and learn from listening to that. And I know that it takes a tremendous amount of time, effort, and money to do these. And so I appreciate the work that you've done. And it's been good for the whole community. So thanks.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure, Sam. And it's an absolute delight having you on your show. So thank you. So to all our listeners, thank you so much for tuning in today. If you like what you've heard, you know what you need to do. Like and subscribe to our various channels, iTunes, Spotify, and YouTube. All the links are in the description below. We look forward to welcoming you back for another session soon. Thank you very much.